We're starting a new sermon series. That last year, in the build-up to Christmas, we looked at Isaiah chapters 1 to 12. And we're going to start a series on from chapter 13. But I'm actually going to read chapter 18. You'll see why in a minute. In fact, I'm going to read chapter 17, verse 1, an oracle concerning Damascus. Then chapter 18, verse 1. Ah, land of whirring wings, that is beyond the rivers of Kush, which sends ambassadors by the sea, in vessels of papyrus on the waters. Go, you swift messengers, to a nation tall and smooth, to a people feared near and far, a nation mighty and conquering, whose land the rivers divide. All you inhabitants of the world, you who dwell on the earth, when the signal is raised on the mountains, look. When the trumpet is blown, hear. For thus the Lord said to me, I will quietly look for my dwelling, like clear heat in sunshine, like a cloud of dew in the heat of harvest. For before the harvest, when the blossom is over, and the flower becomes a ripening grape, he cuts off the shoots with pruning hooks, and the spreading branches he lops off and clears away. They shall all of them be left to the birds of prey on the mountains, and to the beasts of the earth, and the birds of prey will summer on them, and all the beasts of the earth will winter on them. At that time tribute will be brought to the Lord of hosts, from a people tall and smooth, from a people feared near and far, a nation mighty and conquering, whose land the rivers divide. To Mount Zion, the place of the name of the Lord of hosts. I just pray. Father, please would you speak to us through these ancient words, through me even, and into the situations each of us face today. Amen. It's a well-known Chinese curse. May you live in interesting times. And we certainly do live in interesting times. I crave boring times now. I crave boring politicians. And the phrase that people keep on using, one of them is unprecedented. We live in unprecedented times. We want to get back to precedented times. People feel insecure. I've never heard the phrase mental health mentioned so much. It's become a real issue. It was before. It really is now. And just think what the last year has thrown at us. We've got 2 months left. Environmental issues, those fires in Australia and in Siberia and elsewhere. Natural disasters, man-made explosions, the virus. Now, whatever you make of that and the numbers, whether they're, lots of people saying they're pessimistic numbers and optimistic numbers, but whatever it leads to, we've seen and we are seeing a huge economic downturn. Civil liberties have been curbed and all the things that are flowing out from that. Politics, well, protests about the environment, about race, other things. And of course, today is Remembrance Sunday. We think today of the cost of war. And these there's various things that we would normally be saddened to see on the news, but we'd be shocked to see happening somewhere like mainland Europe or the US, and they're happening down our street. Hence, stress, mental health things we could never imagine happening to us. And so the natural question is what does God think? What does the Bible have to say about that? And here we come to the book of Isaiah in chapters 13 to 23. In fact, Isaiah as a whole. And if I've called this series that we look at over the next few weeks, Light in the Darkness. And there's a message there of comfort, a sort of recalibrating when things do go wrong and we hit hard times, that they are not, or they need not, be hopeless. Now, last year we looked at Isaiah 1 to 12, and nicely flows in to Christmas. And I was thinking what to do next and wondered about the next bit of Isaiah, and I read from chapter 18. It actually seems now so fitting to where we are. Now, this is often Isaiah is a well-known book because of those explicit prophecies about Jesus Christ, and some of them explicitly point us to Christmas, and some explicitly to Good Friday and Easter. And towards the end of the book, those wonderfully hopeful chapters about a new heavens and a new earth. But there are some bits that are obscure to us. This is one of them, and not many people apparently preach on it. And I use, as some of you do, the Murray McShane Bible reading plan. It takes us through the Old Testament once a year and the Psalms and the New Testament twice a year. And you get to this bit of Isaiah, and it's very repetitive. And it just bangs out again. An oracle to so-and-so. Woe are you. Oracle to so-and-so. Woe are you. And there's a reason why it repeats. And but what I'm just going to do is draw out some themes. But just a reminder of where we've of what the book is about. We looked at the first 12 chapters. It's written at a time, a lot of it under the reign of King Hezekiah. And what's happened already before the book is Israel has split into a northern and southern kingdom. Israel is the majority in the north, and Judah, which is one of the tribes, is in the south. It's Judah and Benjamin in the south. And Isaiah is addressing the south. He's addressing Judah. And the thing about Judah, in contrast to Israel, is actually they look pretty good. Religiously, they look good, and they're politically and economically secure. But Isaiah has warned them in the first five chapters that that is only superficial. And eventually, what is the rot in their hearts is going to work its way out. And so the first five chapters are all about God's judgment on them. And that's going to come in the form of exile. They're going to be taken out of their land. Chapter 6 is his commission to prophesying, and he's going to bring this good news of God's mercy, and everyone's going to ignore him. But then we see up to chapter 12 that God, regardless, God is going to send his Christ. He's going to send the Christ, born of a virgin, and he will save and rule his people. And actually, he's going to have a global impact. So that's so far. Then chapters 13 to 23, you've got a series of 10 oracles addressed to 11 nations, including Israel and Judah. And Babylon is addressed twice. And what he's doing is addressing those countries around Judah. And they've got one thing in common. They're all under threat from Assyria, which is a hostile superpower. And these 11 nations have different ways of dealing with that problem. But God judges is bringing judgment on those nations. Specifically, the way they're trying to deal with it. Not only so that they're drawing together, they're drawing their own wisdom to keep Assyria on bay. And that is the point at which God judges them. But the point is not that Isaiah is addressing those nations and saying that this terrible stuff is happening to you, and then we would somehow apply that to Boris, Biden and Trump, or Merkel and Macron. Rather, Isaiah is addressing Judah. He's addressing the people of God. He's addressing the church, but showing how God is dealing with the nations, but for his church, for their comfort and correction. And the point is, God is warning his church not to trust what the others trust in, but to trust in the promises of God, which leads us to obedience. Now, that's so obviously right, isn't it? I mean, like, you need me to tell you that. But why does he repeat himself for 10 chapters? Actually, it goes on into similar sort of theme for a couple of chapters after that. Why does he have to repeat himself for 10 chapters? Because we make the same mistakes, don't we? There are two kinds of sermons, not so much as they're delivered, but as we hear them. Those that impart new information, you go, oh, I didn't know that about God before. And others that ask, well, you already know it, but why didn't you do it? We need to hear those almost as much, perhaps more, than the ones where we learn new things. Why is it so hard for us? Because there are things that we're tempted to trust that are just there in front of us. They're visible and they're now, and we can get hold of them easily. But with God, we have to rely on a promise that we can't see, and we have to wait. And often it is a rough route as we wait. But he is certain. The only other certainty in life is that everything else will fail sooner or later. And so we see how this kind of tumbles into the New Testament and into the Christian life today. In the face of threat, where will we turn? in a lockdown, in whatever else we face. It exposes what it actually is that we trust in. And now, where will we turn? So there are three themes, because there's too much to do in these 10 chapters, but although we justified to do a sermon on each, I wondered if we might feel a bit battered by the end. But three themes. The first one is a warning against fake assurance. And then the other two is rather we trust in God, but two parts to that, God's sovereignty and God's mercy. So a warning against fake assurance, and then in God's, to trust rather in God's sovereignty and then his mercy. And the first bit we'll spend a bit more time on. So the warnings about false assurances. And the first one is the world, just a blanket statement, the world. So chapter 13 through to 14:27. And then it comes up again in 21:1-10, is the two oracles against Babylon. Now, in Isaiah, when he says Babylon, he means Babylon. He means the plot of land around what we call Iran and the political power that was called Babylon. But spoiler alert, Isaiah, as he goes on, Babylon is actually the threat to Judah. They thought Assyria was the threat, but Babylon is an up-and-coming superpower that will replace Assyria. And so the temptation for Judah is to put their trust in Babylon. They've got great armies, technology, engineering, trade, power. They will keep you safe. Now, later in the Old Testament, and right at the end of the Bible in Revelation, the word Babylon comes to represent the world. It could be, depending on the context, politics and power or religion, but it's always anti-God and oppresses his people. And so the temptation always is for God's people to get with the power, get where the power is and be safe there. And they're warned not to. So here in chapter 13, God describes them as a tool. Babylon, this superpower, is just a tool in God's hand to do his work, to judge the nations and to refine his people. And then in 14:1-7, they're actually taunted because of how they end up. For all their power, God judges them. And then in chapter 21:1-20, the unthinkable happens. Babylon falls. That would have been unimaginable. And in 14:1-2, the whole point of all this is to show that God's people are secure without them. And so trusting the world, whatever we mean by that, whether it's techniques or how we approach things and view things, trusting the world looks wise. It always looks wise and sensible and prudent. But ultimately, it's folly. So that's a big umbrella sort of theme. Some things that spell out of that really. Circumstances, Philistia in 14:28-32, they rejoice because it says their rod is broken. So in the context that these oracles don't follow in sort of historical order, but Isaiah's dealing with them thematically. But what happens with the Philistia is the Assyrian king that was oppressing them died, and they all rejoiced, but their successor was worse. So we're not to look to our circumstances. That often indicates that things are going one way and they go another. It's a false security. Where will we look then? Well, in the same section, in 14:32, he says, "What will one answer the messengers of the nation? The Lord has founded Zion, and in her the afflicted of his people find refuge." Just as we started in Psalm 46, it's in him we find refuge. In alliances, a theme that runs through Isaiah, and arguably through those what we call the history books, that's from 1 Samuel through to 2 Chronicles, is don't trust in alliances outside of God's people. It's not that we don't trade with them or deal with them, but don't trust in alliances with them. And especially here, the prophet addresses Syria, Israel, that's the northern kingdom, remember, and Cush, which we often will call Ethiopia. And they're united together by an alliance with Assyria, and they're tempting, and we read this in Isaiah, we read this in the history books, like 2 Kings, that Hezekiah, the king of Judah, is tempted to join in with them, and he mustn't. But the reason is that historically these three nations are all opposed to the Davidic king, to God's Christ. He's true ruler on earth. And so they're saying, ally with us, but we oppose your Christ. We don't recognise him as king. As one commentator I read put on this, that despite all the promises, all human policies lead to death. Whatever they promise, they lead to death. Then there's economics and finance. The Bible has much to say about this and wise use of money, both prudence and generosity, but ultimately not to rely on it. And so here in 19, 5 to 10, Egypt's economy crashes. Egypt had been a superpower. Military, they're not at this stage, but they are still economically powerful. Their economy crashes. 21, 13 to 17, the Arab trading routes are threatened. It talks about their camels. So these are the trains and trucks of their day. 23, 1 to 2 is about Tyre, a great port. But their ships, their imports and exports has led them to great wealth. Their wealth is going to crash. They'd be very safe, you'd think, because of their position to trade with the world. And Isaiah prophesies the unthinkable. These places of secure wealth, these secure, wealthy economies are going to come crashing down through situations they couldn't imagine. Now, remember, the message is not so much to them, you people, entire economy is going to crash, but to Judah. Where will you invest? Who will you trust? You know that phrase, safe as houses. Well, you know, some things we thought were safe and secure, frankly, are not. Now, maybe you feel this doesn't really apply to you because you don't think that you're rich. But of course, relatively, globally, historically, you are mind-bogglingly rich. But also, we trust in finances, we have insurance and so on, which is all fine. It is wise to do that sort of thing. But where do you trust? When it all goes wrong and it's taken away from you, where will you trust? And so we're not to put our alliances in, for Isaiah's day, military, but finances. And so, well, what will we trust? Well, perhaps wisdom. I guess thinking about what we know. Academia. Well, Egypt was the world leader in that department for many years. It was a byword for wisdom. And what we have in 19, 11 to 15 is their wisdom is shown to be empty. In 21, 11 to 12, we have an oracle to Duma, which we think is Edom. And it talks there about total confusion. They ask these good searching questions, but they are clueless where to look. And that's a repeated theme through the Bible, the worldly wisdom versus God's wisdom. Often what is wise from God's point of view looks like absolute foolishness to the world. It's counterintuitive because we have a wisdom that's revealed to us from outside. On our Thursday midweeks, and we joined in with an Oak Hill conference one evening, we saw that thinking Christianly is not obvious to us. We have to be deliberate about it. It's not our default position, but it's important. We have a perspective the world does not have. Now, take all we covered so far, and we think of the modern church, which depends so much on technique. We're depending on technology right now, but on technique and approaches and resources that we take from the world. And Isaiah is saying, be very careful about that. But one more warning is phony religion. And this comes in two forms in the book of Isaiah. The first comes Moab style, chapter 15, and their false gods. And that's the reason for God's judgment on Moab. But later there's warnings, recurring warnings in Isaiah for God's people who always absorb that. And it's always a danger for them. They say the Lord, they give the right words, but their behaviour, their religious practices and worship is just copying the pagans. But perhaps a more dangerous kind, which is how the book of Isaiah starts, and we see it, he brings it up again in chapter 22, his oracle to Jerusalem. Then it's worth a sermon by itself. Maybe I'll do that. But he calls them the valley, Jerusalem, the valley of vision. But it's ironic, they have no vision. And what they have is a religion that's on display that looks good, but it's hollow. It's self-congratulating. And that's exemplified in their leader, Shebna. He's a civil servant in the time of Hezekiah. You can read about him in 2 Kings. He's actually one of the goodies. But Isaiah shows that in his heart he's proud. He's planning to have a great monument built to his honour. Notice God is concerned about the form, not to copy the world, but also the content, that externally the form can be okay, but the motive can be all wrong. So God judges by removing Shebna and giving what a Shebna's to Eliakim. It's a co-worker. They're the envoys who go to the Assyrian armies under the time of Hezekiah. But Eliakim is different. He's humble. And so God takes all that was Shebna's and gives to Eliakim. And Eliakim is robed, though he was humble. But just as we build up our hope in that chapter, God honouring the humble servant leader, and you think, oh, that sounds familiar. End of chapter 22, he says the tent peg is removed. So not even someone like Eliakim can carry the weight of government. We need someone else who is a humble leader who can carry this. Now, it's all very obvious, this, and yet he takes 10 chapters, not in historical order, but 10 themed chapters, because God's people continually, no matter what they already know, go towards what they can see and what's now. They're not patient. They're not trusting in God's promise. And that's always our problem. That's why we need, when you do that, the McShane thing, every day you get you do your Isaiah reading, got three others. We need to hear that. Rather, what Isaiah takes us to is to God. And very briefly, I want us to think about his sovereignty, but then to think of his mercy. So just briefly, God's sovereignty. All over these verses are about judgment is his sovereignty. Especially chapter 23, verses 8 to 14. But I'll just read to you verse 9. It says, the Lord of hosts has purposed it to defile the pompous pride of all glory, to dishonour all the honoured of the earth. God purposed it. God purposed it. So we saw Babylon opposes, the forces opposed to God, and they oppress his people, but they're just a tool. God uses them to judge other nations, but to purify his own. This is a great mystery, but God uses his judgment to bring justice and good to his people. Which actually we're bringing up over the next couple of weeks in Romans 8. So when we think, well, why COVID? Why lockdowns? And we did this when it's all kicked off. We looked at the book of Amos, and the answer in a nutshell is we don't know. But God has not lost control, and he uses what is happening. Now, most ministers and many Christians fear for the church. I read an article a couple of months ago that 20 to 30% of churches, they think, will never return from all this. They won't be viable. And many will be harmed. And maybe CPC will be harmed. I think we'll be viable. But this may have done us damage. We're concerned about that, aren't we? But God has not lost control. He is sifting. He's purifying. And the question is asked through all this, will he remain faithful? So God uses history, he uses opposition, persecution, all sorts of things that are very, very hard to bring people to himself and to mature his own people. So pain does not mean that God has lost control. And Isaiah, much of Isaiah is, it seems quite hard work, but it actually is written to comfort. It keeps on saying comfort, speak tenderly. Comfort to his people with this. And what Isaiah was saying to the people of his day is, look, you've got a hard few years ahead of you. And you need to know that through them, God is with you. He's not abandoned you. He's got it. And that is true for us. But also God's mercy. And this is very striking, because in that reading program, as I mentioned, each morning for 10 weeks plus, God's justice and his wrath and his judgment. But it's important to notice that that is interspersed, dropped in with wonderful comments about his mercy. In fact, in his sovereignty, they're two sides of the same coin. And what is striking is not just that his mercy is to restore his people, Judah, after the exile, he's going to rescue them and bring them back, but even to his arch enemies. So Moab, even Moab were terrible to God's people and have all kinds of things said about God's cursing on them. But we get in chapter 16, verses 3 to 5, it says, give counsel, grant justice, make your shade like light. This is Isaiah speaking to Moab. Make your shade like night at the height of noon. Shelter the outcasts. Do not reveal the fugitive. Let the outcasts of Moab sojourn with you. Be a shelter to them from the destroyer, when the oppressor is no more, and destruction has ceased, and he who tramples underfoot has vanished from the land. Then a throne will be established in steadfast love, and on it will sit in faithfulness, in the tent of David, one who judges and seeks justice, and is swift to do righteousness. Even to Moab, the gospel is offered. Egypt. Now you think about Egypt. That's where it all starts in Exodus, isn't it? Those who oppress God's people. And the whole theme of don't go back to Egypt. Egypt, in chapter 19, from verse 16 onwards, God's sovereign actions against Egypt in judgment is used to turn them, to turn their thinking initially, and then to bring them to God. And so God wounds in order to heal. He's like a surgeon. And that's very striking, isn't it? And shocking and perhaps offensive, if you think how God's people often thought. In chapter 19, verse 25, it says, whom the Lord of hosts has blessed, saying, talking about Egypt and Assyria, blessed be Egypt, my people, and Assyria, the work of my hands, and Israel, my inheritance. It's just remarkable, isn't it? Not only does he send a saviour to Egypt, he says in verse 20, but he says that Egypt and Assyria, so Egypt, the ones who needed Israel rescuing out of back in the day, Assyria, the superpower that is their threat at the time Isaiah's writing, are going to share with Israel the promises of Abraham. The promises that come to God's people are going to come to Egypt and Assyria. 23, 15 to 18, Tyre will be restored. And that wonderful chapter 18 that I read, addressed to Cush stroke Ethiopia. And then he turns from them, though, to talk about the nations. And that ends in that verse 7. At that time, tribute will be brought to the Lord of hosts. And he goes on, from people tall and smooth, from people feared near and far, a nation mighty and conquering, those whose land the rivers divide, to Mount Zion, the place of the name of the Lord of hosts. All nations will come to God's Christ. And that's the purpose that runs through the whole Bible, and of that we start with God's people, Israel, but that will go to all the nations. Isaiah is a great book of mission. It's the Romans of the Old Testament. And talking about the work of Jesus Christ and his body, the church, a people of God from all nations, languages, skin tone, and so on. And so if we're to have God's love and mercy, we want to not just do good to people, we want to do that, we want to tell them of Jesus Christ, if we love them, if we're concerned about them. And in Isaiah language, that means calling them to worship. It means showing them God's greatness in Jesus Christ and to respond with all our heart. So we need to show that it's anchored with us before anyone takes any notice of us. But then we need to say, evangelism is saying, look how great God is. You really need to get with the program. You need to worship him. And this is the forgiveness that's on offer in to enable you to do that. So notice how this ties in with Romans in the evenings. His mercy is shown to sinners in Jesus Christ. God shows mercy to sinners in Jesus Christ. 10 chapters, and actually one more to look at on this sort of theme about judgment. But in judgment, there is mercy. And mercy to the worst of sinners. Whoever you are, whatever you've done, that mercy is held out to you today. Now, some important caveats, and these are in the text, in these chapters. It's not me just spoiling it. But to benefit from God's mercy, not everyone will experience God's mercy. It is there, presented to everybody, but not everyone will benefit. And so we're to ditch our reliance in those things we talked about earlier. And we're to stand before God empty-handed. Now, we saw that mercy was an offer to Moab. But actually, if you were to read on, they don't benefit. Because sadly, they forfeited it because they would not turn from their gods. Egypt, that wonderful prophecy about Egypt and Assyria. But in the next bit, chapter 21 to 5, there's this crushing realism that it's not going to happen in Isaiah's lifetime. In his lifetime, there would only be rejection and hostility. So when Isaiah talks about, as he does from time to time, the straight path, What he's saying is God is going to get you from there to there, for sure. But it's not an easy path. Now, a wonderful feature about Isaiah, I think one of the things I like about him, is his honesty. It's not a pessimistic book. It's not an optimistic book. It's a realistic book that he is preparing you that it at times is going to be hard, and perhaps for a long time. But that doesn't mean that it's a failure. God is going to carry you to the other side. The destination is assured. The route is bumpy. English understatement. Now, a related caveat. There was a contrast we thought about Shebna and Eliakim in 22 verses 20 to 24. And that's how God operates, isn't it? That the proud he brings down and the humble he raises. We often hear that proverb or see it worked out. He brings down those with pride. He brings up the humble and he robes them. Those who robe themselves, he takes them off. Those who humble themselves, he gives them royal robes. The prodigal son, in pride, he runs away from the father. But then he humbles himself and empty-handed, he comes and returns and the father robes him. One of the things I think in this passage is about the Tower of Babel. Babel is where we get the word Babylon from. And if you remember, the word Babel in Babylonian means gateway to the god. In Hebrew, same word, means gibberish, jibber jabber. It's Babel. And so a city that is built by, so that you have the two, they think they're wise, but they're foolish. They're nonsense. And so we have a choice. Back in Genesis and here in Revelation, the choice is a city built by men building their way to God for their own glory, or a city built by God where God is glorified. Now, which city is your home, ultimately? And Isaiah, as he continues, that question returns repeatedly. Where is home? It's not exile in Babylon that's temporary. It's not, though, as they may have thought, their earthly Jerusalem, but a greater city. And they will be brought there by a great king. Now, that great king himself was exiled in our place. He experienced an exile for us. His exile, though, was not from a plot of land. His exile was from life, an exile to death on the cross. And we return from his death at the resurrection with him. Now, hopefully, I've already spelt out the timeliness of all this. It's always significant, but perhaps we feel it more now at this time than normally. We're anxious about our health. Perhaps you're anxious about the effect the virus may have on you. You might be anxious about the effect that lockdown might have on you, or that you can't get to the doctors as easily, and all the knock-on effects. As many say, that the prevention of the virus is perhaps even worse than the virus. Who knows? You might be anxious about your job and your finances, about the future of CPC and the wider church. Who will you trust? Who will carry you ultimately? So to the Christian and the non-Christian listening in, that where I want to finish is quite similar. To the Christian, to the church, we make our plans. That's fine. That's wise. But all our plans are provisional. That was always so. But don't we feel it now, after numerous cancelled holidays? We make plans for church. They're always provisional. All our wisdom and resources are God's, and he can withdraw them at any time. And we're supposed to feel our weakness. We always should do. But aren't we reminded now that we are weak? We're pathetic. But he doesn't take his spirit from those who put their trust in Christ. And that means, and he gives us his means. So we've got the word. We've got prayer. We're to use what he gave us and to trust in him and the work of his spirit in us and to call out to him because we're helpless. So trust in his promises, and to trust in his promises leads us to obedience. Now, non-Christian, if you're still listening, do you feel anxious and vulnerable? The times we're in are uncertain, and the truth is, the current times only express what is always true. That was always true. It's just obvious now. All the things you have or turn to have one thing in common, and one thing that's certain about them. They will all fail. They will all end, sooner or later. Your money, your reputation, your wisdom, your whatever power you have will wane and die. And so when you're with nothing and you come to God, then what? Well, don't make the mistake that Moab did. Turn now so that on that day you face God with confidence as a friend and father in Jesus Christ, not a foe who snubbed him. And he'll carry you on the rather bumpy road that gets you there.